What's cracking, folks? I'm Jared Dubin, and this is Quo Vadimus. We've got Seth Partnow on the line to discuss last night's TNT basketball games between the Oklahoma City Thunder and Miami Heat and the San Antonio Spurs and Memphis Grizzlies. Seth, what's up, man?
How you doing?
I'm doing well. I can't wait until we get a week with two good games. It seems like every week we get one game that has a lot of good stuff to talk about and then one game that's not all that great. That was actually the case last night, too. The Thunder Heat game, which we're going to talk about first, was a good, close game all the way down to the end. And the second game basically became a blowout midway through the third quarter or so. We're going to start with Oklahoma City, Miami, though. And within that, do you want to start with the late game stuff, or do you want to sort of work our way up to that?
Is there really much else to talk about aside from the late game? I mean, I guess there is, but it just, that's the part that's going to stick out in everyone's mind, I think, just because, you know, everything that came before was fun and interesting, and KD did some stuff, and Wade did some stuff, and Tyler Johnson had some moments, and Waiters had some moments, but then kind of the last 4 minutes was kind of like very much old boss, same as the new boss or new boss, same as the old boss for OKC especially.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then, because with about 5 minutes left in the game, it was tied 91-91. You know, obviously, it remained close throughout the rest of the game. Miami won by 2 points. But like you said, a lot of the Thunder's, you know, sort of late game offense hiccups came back. They were tied 91-91. And then they had sort of, I wrote down a few possessions in a row. They had a Westbrook isolation that didn't really go anywhere. They had a Kevin Durant very slow developing pick and roll that didn't really go anywhere and ended with a long jumper. And, you know, then at one point they were tied coming out of a timeout, and they ran a play which had become sort of a pet favorite under Scott Brooks, with Westbrook sort of passing the ball off almost immediately and then running to the other side of the court to set a pin-down screen for Durant. And it just seemed like the Heat knew exactly what was coming, especially on that particular play. And Gerald Green pushed Durant almost all the way out to midcourt on his catch on that play. And it wound up really going pretty much nowhere. You know, this is the sort of thing that the Thunder hired Billy Donovan because he was supposed to inject some variety into their late game offense and into their play calling and stuff like that. Now, what do you think about that, you know, last night and then, you know, from what you've seen from them on the season as a whole?
Well, so I've always been of the opinion that a lot of their late game stuff was more on the players than you know, the design of stuff wasn't great, obviously, but it's largely a personnel thing. And one thing you mentioned there was, you know, Gerald Green pushing Kevin Durant way out on the catch. That's not a new thing. That's, you know, that makes it, you wonder, why can't they run stuff? Well, they, like, think about various playoff series. For example, like if Tony Allen was ever guarding Durant and where he would catch the ball in kind of late game situations, because, you know, the refs swallow the whistles and more physicality is allowed close to the end of the game, and pushing Durant out to 30 feet on the catch is something that basically everyone does. And I don't, is how much is that on the coach? If he's, you know, by nature of his build, that's, you know, something that he's still susceptible to, I think. But it's a, you know, it's a player thing to some extent. And it's not just Durant. It's, you know, the two other smalls on the floor not being guys who are necessarily respected has never helped. Serge Ibaka's screening was woeful last night, was something I particularly noticed. He was, like, they were trying to do something semi-Clippers-like, where, you know, the Clippers, when they played, like, Crawford, Chris Paul lineups, do things where Chris Paul would be kind of on the right wing, Crawford on the left wing, and they just run alternating screen and rolls with Blake Griffin bouncing back and forth. OKC was trying to do that, and Ibaka was whiffing on multiple screens per possession, like almost literally waving at the guy as he started his not even really roll, his kind of semi-pop float to the elbow area thing.
The one screen I thought that he actually hit somebody was where Russ and Ibaka were running to pick and roll on the left side of the court, and Kevin Durant sort of slid up behind it, and they got finally, you know, that cross-court pass to Durant for a three on the wing. You know, that little lefty hook pass that Russ will throw when he's moving to his left.
Yeah.
That was the one time I thought that Ibaka set a good screen and really sort of rolled down the lane rather than doing his usual float thing, and it worked.
Yep, and on that particular play, I mean, even that wasn't the greatest shot, but Durant's defender did take that kind of one extra step towards the roll that gave, you know, if you've got a 7-footer with 3-point range, you don't need a lot of room for it to be a decent shot, and you know, Ibaka getting a good screen and rolling hard just did. It drew that defender just half a step down the lane, and that's all they needed.
And that's all he really ever needs, which is why it's so sort of disconcerting when they can't seem to get him even that smidgen of space on some plays. And that was why I thought I made particular note of the pin-down play, because usually you would think with you know, a guy as dangerous as Russ screening for Durant, you'd be able to create a little bit of space. But it just looked like, you know, as soon as they came out of that timeout, the Heat knew that play was coming. And Gerald Green started, you know, jumping the route on the screen before Westbrook even got there. And he didn't have a chance to really set the screen on him and give KD enough space.
Yeah. Also, but some of this is also design. Like, I guess I've been known for being a defender of Scott Brooks, and I have for, a mild defender, I guess.
You disagree about stuff, because I've definitely been known to be the opposite of a defender of Scott Brooks.
Yeah, well, no, but you know, the one thing that I kind of did always appreciate was even, okay, they're doing this isolation stuff, but they would actually start it oftentimes with kind of a three-man game on the right side of the floor, where they'd kind of have a back screen, then a down screen with Collison, who is both a good screener and good passer, and Westbrook and Durant kind of exchanging. And for whatever reason, okay, it ends up with an ISO, but it ends up with an ISO with kind of things happening on the opposite side of the floor and decent spacing, so that fine, Durant's ending up going one-on-one, but he's ending up going one-on-one, not one-on-three, like they ended up being forced to run basically every play last night, because there was, you know, everything else going on the floor was so stagnant, and the positioning of the players was such that Miami was almost in like a 3-2 zone, with the defenders on the corner guys almost stepping all the way up to like the third hash on the free throw line, just to kind of every time Westbrook or Durant beat their guy, they basically just saw like a wall of bodies and no real options to at least from their standpoint, no real options to throw the ball, whether it was, you know, Waiters or Roberson or whoever.
Yeah, that was always the thing for me with Scottie Brooks, was that, you know, you'd wind up, it's fine to have to design a play for Durant or Westbrook to beat their man one-on-one, but there needs to be some sort of other option on the play other than that, in case the entire defense is, you know, sort of trained in on them. And I thought early in the season it looked like Donovan had injected, you know, a little bit more backside motion and things with, you know, four or five options baked in. But, you know, once, I guess over sort of the last couple of weeks, it doesn't seem like there's been quite as much of that. And I don't know. Late in games, I guess, sort of just disappears, as opposed to, you know, the rest of the game, it seems to flow a little bit more. And it's a concern. Obviously, they're only 20 games in, and you know, you build on things throughout the year, and we'll see what happens. But for now, you know, that game was not necessarily encouraging in terms of the whole. Billy Donovan was brought in to give their offense more variety and make sure they don't bog down late games. Rationalization.
I think there's a lot of things that we can take issue with for Donovan, including this in the fourth quarter of last night. But I also, I mean, you got to make the point that, you know, it's the players still have to execute. I don't think anyone's drawing up a play saying, hey, Kevin Durant, you know, go really wide around this pick that you're not giving a chance to get set and catch the ball with your back to the basket at 28 feet and then go 1-on-3 and shoot a pull-up three with a guy in your face. No one's drawing that play up. So to some extent,
well, they might draw it up for Steph Curry, but that's a different.
Yeah, I mean, so and you know, to some extent, it's on, you know, the players to, and there's, you know, there's a coaching and preparation element to this, but it also it's on the players to execute that, and I think that over time Durant is just most comfortable. All right, I know I can catch the ball up there, and then I'm confident that I can beat my guy and do some stuff. And you know what? They are good enough that it still works at times. I mean, you know, he got some actually fairly decent looks off of that didn't go in. You know, there's one where he kind of crossed a guy up and shot. Actually, you know, it's the kind of shot that if it goes in, it's like, oh, Kevin Durant is nasty. But then it doesn't go in. It's like, oh, it's same old ISO stuff again. So it's tempting to call that just terrible because some of those shots didn't go in last night, but it's certainly not aesthetically pleasing. But the point is that the attention to detail of the execution is something that, you know, like, look who they have on the floor. Say whatever you want positive about Durant and Westbrook and you know, Deion Waiters and Serge Ibaka. I don't think precise is an adjective that would be used to describe any of their play, right?
Not necessarily. No, I mean, maybe Durant in terms of, you know, the way he can, when he does finally get the ball one-on-one, you know, whether or not it takes him a little bit longer to get open to get that ball. You know, he's very sort of economical in his movement. Obviously, Westbrook is fairly economical within his fast switch movements, but often dribbles himself into, you know, Bolivian, as Mike Tyson would say, before he actually uses that explosiveness in short areas. But no, I don't think that, you know, yeah, you're right that, you know, they're not necessarily precise in terms of when they're running a specific play. And I think that that contributed to KD getting pushed all the way out to 28 feet. You know, it was obvious that they were running that pin down play. And Gerald Green saw it before it happened, and he didn't let Russ screen him. So that's definitely something that contributes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we can beat this horse enough. But the other concerning part, I guess, and this is something that is not new, is kind of something that is unequivocally a coaching decision, and that's lineup staggering. Or
yep.
Not staggering. And,
yep.
All right. Like, I get, you know, stealing a couple minutes at the beginning of the fourth quarter. You know, that's, I don't agree with it, but I get that strategy. As, you know, something, because, you know, you don't necessarily want one of your guys, you know, all right, playing the entire fourth quarter and then figuring out a way to, all right, he's going to start the fourth quarter, then he's going to come out of the game for 4 minutes. That's, you know, I can see why that is not appealing, even though that's possibly how I would do it. To, you know, all right, Russ starts the fourth quarter, comes out at the first time out, comes back at 6 minutes left or something like that. But it's baffling that they would come back from the there was a timeout with about 9:30 left in the fourth, if I have that right. And it's baffling to me that they would come back from that first timeout in the fourth quarter with neither Russ or KD on the floor.
Yeah, it looks
And
like I marked it down to it's 8:47.
Okay. All right, so they got all the way. That makes it even worse. They got all the way down to like the scheduled media timeout, and you know Miami brought their guys back a possession or two early, and you know got a few possessions of Wade working against you know the backups and some of that is you know the fool's gold of Deion Waiters hitting a couple shots. There was actually that pull up three he hit early in the fourth quarter probably.
Yep. That put
kept
them up 87-85 with 6:40
yep.
left just before the two guys came back in.
Yeah. And it's like he misses that shot, they call a timeout right away, get their guys back in. And so it's like that's almost a bad thing for him. That goes in, even though
if you have Russ and KD out to start the fourth quarter, like at least have Ibaka out there. Like you can't come out with Augustine, Waiters, Morrow, Collis, and Kanter for the start of the fourth quarter of a close game. I think they were up by 3 points at the start of the fourth, if I'm remembering correctly. I don't have the score written down, but it was a close game and it stayed a close game through those first few minutes. But Royce Young said on Twitter as soon as the guys came back in, he's like, Oklahoma City was only -3 in those whatever it was 6 minutes without Durant and Westbrook. That's not bad. And then I was thinking to myself, like, that assumes that they had to have both of those guys out, which is not true at all. And then it was funny because immediately after I thought that, Bob Vulgaris tweeted the exact same thing. Bob, of course, the NBA gambler and thinker we know on Twitter as @HaralaBob, he said that exact same thing. And I was like, that's exactly right. Like, you don't need to have those guys both out. And then you wouldn't be worrying about only being -3 in those 6 minutes. So, you know, it's a balance, and there are ways to do it that you can get away with it. You know, I wouldn't necessarily have them out at the same time at all, ever. There's really no particular reason for it. But if you're going to have those two guys out, I think you got to at least have Ibaka out there. So at least you have a true plus defender on the back line if you're not going to have your two shot creation guys out there. Because a Collis and Kanter front line isn't doing anything for you.
No, and Kanter being on the floor when your offense is going to be all Deion Waiters ISOs is kind of, you know, and, it, you know, the part of the reason they were only -3 is because, you know, Waiters had a nice stretch at the start of the fourth quarter, which you know, on one hand, good for him. On the other, yeah, exactly. It's not something you can count on. It's very well. Austin will. it's very Doc Rivers saying, well, Austin will carry the offense for these couple minutes while our guys are resting. It's like that's a hope, not a plan.
Right. There were a couple nice things that OKC did throughout the game before sort of the fourth quarter stretch that we're talking about here, which seems to be the source of a lot of frustration. They had a really nice set in the second quarter that got Westbrook a dunk on a backdoor play, which I actually remembered that I wrote about that set 3 years ago, which was funny. You know, Durant came off sort of a double screen handoff situation that found Westbrook cutting on the back door after he gave up the ball. You know, it's a little bit different than the variation they ran a couple of years ago on which Westbrook was one of the guys setting the screen for Durant. This time he was the guy cutting back door and it was Kevin Martin that was the backdoor guy last time. And this time Andre Robertson cut across the court rather than going back door. And it sort of looked like a cycle, which I think worked better because it brought Durant and Westbrook to the same side of the floor where you have so much attention and made it look like the play was designed for something happening on the other side. I thought that was really nice. And then there was a point also in the second quarter where they ran sort of that Dirk-style pick and roll where, you know, Dirk will sort of set what looks like a screen at the top of the key, but he's really just hugging the point guard so he can drag him into a post-up at the free throw line. And Russ and Durant did that to get Wade switched onto Durant at the free throw line, and Dirk just sort of drove right at him for a layup. Or sorry, Dirk. Durant just drove right at him for a layup. And those are the kind of things that using Durant and Westbrook in conjunction like that, you should be able to get good shots fairly consistently. And I don't know why they didn't go to that later on in the game. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason is that, you know, if they, you know, they go to that later in the game, Wade just pushes, just, you know, basically walks Durant out, you know, 5 feet higher up the floor, and all of a sudden it's a very different play. Because again, that's, you know, the level of physicality allowed is just higher in the fourth quarter. You know, you can say a foul in the first should be a foul in the fourth, but that is not, and has basically never been the way the game has been officiated. So, and just recognizing that it's just important in recognizing why, you know, teams don't always run, you know, intricate, you know, timing plays in the fourth quarters, because you just can't expect the timing to work. If off the ball, the defense is given a lot of leeway to clutch, grab, push, grab, trip, whatever.
So we've spent, you know, I guess almost 20 minutes now talking only about Oklahoma City, obviously. There was another team in the game. Did you see anything you particularly liked or didn't like from Miami in this one?
Their defense has been stellar this year, and you could kind of, especially down the stretch, you could really see why, how they, you know, were very cognizant of how much attention they needed to pay to the other Oklahoma City players, and they did so, and that like I said, allowed them to just show Durant and Westbrook just a lot of bodies. Anytime that they were trying to, you know, work from the top of the floor. So that was impressive. Their offense is, their starting lineup is just such a weird mix of players that it's understandable to me that their offense is kind of kludgy, because, you know, you've got Wade and Dragic is always sort of a weird fit style-wise in the backcourt, and then Whiteside, who, as an aside, I don't think I would want to be the team that pays him what he's going to get this summer.
By the way, for staring down Spo with a death stare when he got pulled from the game with like 5 minutes
right
left, by the way.
Right.
He wanted to murder Spo. It was hilarious.
if the Heat end up re-signing him and using bird rights, and well, they don't even have, actually, given his contract status, they won't even have, you know, real bird rights on him. So, and he kind of got talked up big at halftime, and he's, I don't know, without going too crazy on this, I think he's very much a stats first player whose box score stats overstate his overall contributions to.
Well, and I think that's shown. You know, the Heat's defense has been so incredible this year. It's been significantly better with him on the bench. I think Fred Katz wrote about it yesterday or the day before. Some almost like 12 points or something like that. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but
yeah,
it's been much better with Whiteside on the bench.
And some of that is just their kind of their bench unit is it's as much about the guys coming in for him being, you know, forming a really good defense. Like you put four of your guys out there are Tyler Johnson, Justice Winslow, McBob, and Bosch. Like that's the basis of a good mobile defensive unit. Like McRoberts he's obviously in great physical shape this year. He and kind of non-box, like the opposite in terms of non-box score contributions on both ends of the floor are.
He's passing up
really
a ton of open shots,
yeah,
but looks great on defense.
Yeah,
I mean, that'd be really well. I guess as well as I can remember, I guess 2 years ago in Charlotte.
Yeah, like that's big part of their of kind of their hounding second unit defense is the fact that, you know, if you run a pick and roll at either Bosch or McRoberts, they can jump out and slide with the ball handler for 2-3 dribbles and allow, you know, Winslow or Johnson, both of whom have when they're recovering back to the ball handler, have very kind of sticky hands to come up with steals, which, you know, is obviously great. So their second unit still remains kind of a pleasant experience if you like good defensive basketball.
The good thing about those guys defending pick and rolls too is that, you know, they're not being quite as aggressive in terms of jumping ball handlers as they were during sort of the flying death machine era. So
right.
it saves those guys and lets them conserve a little bit of energy while still using their ability to guard in space, which works out very well for them when the two play together. And, you know, especially McBob's and Winslow, I think, playing together is a really good combination. And just watching the two of them work, I think, on both ends, because of how willing of passers and cutters they are on one side of the floor and then how well they move their feet on the other. You know, I noted that it looks really, really, really good when the two of them are on the floor. Plus 4.7 points per 100 possessions, 211 minutes coming into the game with McRoberts and Winslow on the floor, which is very good for a bench tandem.
Right. And a big part of that is also the fact that, you know, something that I've been talking about a lot recently is kind of especially big guys getting a chance to work against opponent's second units, like, you know,
right.
top level big guy and Bosch.
It's also good
at
because
center.
They're
yeah.
starter quality players coming off the bench.
Yes.
And I know you've done work about, you know, how many bench players you play at a time. And I would imagine that, you know, guys like that, their numbers go up when they're playing against more bench players. And the two of them, I would imagine, if you looked at the numbers for this season, are playing against more bench players on the floor than starters at almost all times, especially in
mm-hmm.
the first half. You know, obviously the second half, if they're closing games, then that would change a little bit. But I think that that's allowed them to work really well, both together and then individually also. And, I mean, Winslow is just the guy is incredible, man. It's ridiculous. Mike Prada sent out a tweet this morning of one possession where he's just doing, you know, preposterously good work off the ball, denying Kevin Durant a catch at all. I wrote down in my notes for this game that it's one of my favorite chess matches in the league to watch right now. It's just Winslow locking horns with the top scorer on the other team. It's incredible. To be a rookie and to be that good both on and off the ball defensively already, it's amazing. And, you know, the teams with the first 9 picks should hate themselves for allowing Pat Riley to get this guy. You know, basically everybody except, I guess, right now you would think the Wolves and Knicks, based on how their picks are playing, everybody else should be kicking themselves for not taking this guy.
I think let's not get ahead of, too far ahead of ourselves, but – yeah, I mean he's a his limitations, and you know, he still has some on the other end of the floor, make him very much a guy who is much more of an asset to an already competitive team than to a building team, shall we say. Now that. Kind of looking at you, Charlotte, there, though Kaminsky has done some, especially recently, has done pretty well for Charlotte, especially as they kind of move away from Al Jefferson-centricness. But, yeah, in any event. So what else did you see from Miami this game?
Their offense, I guess, is not that much different from the, you know, the manner in which they ran it when LeBron was there. But obviously there, you know, are a lot of different initial actions and stuff just because you don't have LeBron to initiate so much stuff. And, you know, one thing that struck me is there's a lot of design where Wade and Bosch end up with the ball in the mid-range. They love to do that sort of elbow cross screen out of Horns where Bosch catches the ball just outside the right elbow. There's a lot of stuff where Wade will come across on a cross screen under the basket and wind up with the ball 15 feet away, or will come off with a screen in the corner and wind up with the ball at the elbow. I don't necessarily know if they need to extend those plays out to the three-point line. It's not like Wade's going to shoot from there anyway. But it's just interesting to me that, they're such an analytics-friendly organization. You would think that they'd find a way to not wind up with their best scorers catching the ball in the least efficient spot on the floor so often. And I think that that's part of the reason why their offense hasn't been as good as we expected it to be this season. But that's sort of a minor thing, and those two guys are good enough to wind up with efficient shots out of those actions anyway. But the location of catches, I think, is something that is underexplored a little bit. And that was one thing that struck me in watching this game, just how often they first got the ball in those specific spots. But one thing I really liked was late in the game, they were down by two. I think it was just over a minute left, and Spoelstra did not call timeout. He just let Wade walk the ball up the floor. And honestly, it looked like he was going to fall down on his face like 16 times, but he stumbled around on a pick and roll and made a pretty ridiculous shot over two guys in the middle of the paint to tie the game. A lot of coaches would have called timeout to set up basically the exact same play in that
game. Right. You, the ball, especially if the ball is, as it is with most teams, the ball is going to a perimeter scorer. So if all you're going to do is, I think there are reasons why coaches like go with with the ISO. Like we've been talking about, running something is actually pretty hard in that spot. And it's like, all right, here's a guy I trust. Go do something. I know at least we're going to get a shot most of the time. That's, a shot with the guy we want shooting. And that's, there's some logic to that. So if that's going to happen from live play, let it happen.
Right.
It wasn't kind of a twisting, like you said, stumbling kind of floater. It wasn't the prettiest play, but it went in. So yay. Something to note about that is the defensive matchups. Wondering why Roberson is in the game not guarding Wade.
Yeah, having Deion Waiters on Wade for the two most important defensive possessions of the game is not necessarily the way I would go. I guess we can sort of leave it at that. They set up the same exact play on the pick and roll on the possession that they took the lead that eventually won them the game. And Wade dribbled away from the screen that they tried to ice it. And then because Durant had to recover back to Chris Bosh behind the three-point line, Wade was able to get the entire baseline to himself.
That play is kind of illustrative of kind of it wasn't anything fancy. It was kind of a cross screen into a pick and roll. But there was just enough going on with the other guys on the court that there weren't just five guys, opened up to Wade staring at him. And that kind of gave him the space he needed to get, a crease and get all the way to the basket. And that's, in contrast to the Thunder, where there is nothing going on with the other two or three guys and just kind of allowing, if you watch some of their sits down the floor and you, like you said, you watch the positioning of, I think it was Green and Winslow, where the two players guarding Roberson and Waiters. And if you watch their positioning, they're basically like, 6 feet off, 5 feet up the court, off the baseline on both of those guys, just with completely opened up to the ball, not really even paying attention, because they're those other players aren't doing anything. They're just kind of quote spacing in the corner, in spots where they're not doing anything to even occupy their defenders. And that's the contrast is Miami, even though, all right, Winslow is not getting the ball here, but he's doing just enough stuff away from the ball to occupy a defender, just to bring him even like a step and a half out of the paint, further out of the paint. And that's, as we saw, that was kind of all Wade needed to get all the way to the rim and get fouled, is the fact that those guys, instead of sitting in the lane, had to recover to the lane to the drive that, you had to figure was coming.
Well, I think it also helped that their two biggest threats, Wade and Bosh, were both directly involved in the action, rather than one guy being directly involved and one guy being sort of off the ball on the weak side. On the Thunder's few late game possessions when they were, sort of going back and forth after timeouts, it was either only Westbrook involved in the direct action with Ibaka, or then, KD had that ISO with, he just stood there from the time there were 27 seconds left until there were like 8 seconds left and waved everybody off. And Westbrook was completely uninvolved in that play. And then you look at the two late game possessions that Miami ran, and they were both Wade Bosh pick and rolls. Both guys were directly involved in what they were doing, and it scrambled the defense so much more when both of your biggest threats are active in the play. That's why for like 3 or 4 years now, I've been just begging to see them sort of just run that side pick and pop with Westbrook and Durant with the full side of the court cleared. It works like every time during the game. And they very rarely go to it late. I'm not sure if there's a specific reason for that or what it is, but I feel like that would, making them both active parts of the play rather than having one be a bystander, I think would do a lot of good for them.
I agree, but it's also, you need, if they're running kind of a two-man game, you can't run that with five guys guarding those two, which ends up with everyone else just so explicitly standing and watching is kind of what happens. And they're just not doing both by, play execution and personnel. They don't have enough to just occupy some of the attention of the relevant defenders, for those other guys to allow for that to work as well. And that's kind of been my, we've talked about this before. It's like, who are the other two dudes on the floor for Oklahoma City at the end of games? And there aren't really good options, and that has kind of consequences for what their offense looks like in those spots,
And it's not like either Scott Brooks or Billy Donovan is not considering this stuff. Like they're obviously factoring all this stuff in and considering all the different options we're bringing up. We're just, taking this, which is sort of what we're doing in this podcast, sort of criticizing and finding ways for these teams to do well and to do better. Do you have anything else you want to touch on from that game before we move on to the late one?
No, I think there was one th there was in the first half, there was kind of one moment that was like kind of an oh yeah moment, which is, I think we've talked before, and I've certainly talked on other podcasts. I'm sure you've talked on Twitter and whatnot about, it's like, well, why not just Anthony Morrow? And there's one thing that reminded me, in the second quarter, he kind of caught the ball in the corner and kind of jab stepped and shimmied and ended up taking, with some amount of time on the shot clock, about a 17-foot contested pull-up too. And it's like, that's the kind of shot, why he's somewhat fond of that shot, actually. Well, I'm getting run off the three, but I want to shoot, so I'm going to put the ball on the floor and shoot a pull-up too. That could be the exact shot why, coach after coach hasn't maybe trusted him with as many minutes as we would have liked to have seen.
Yeah, it's a balance though. If he was on the floor more, he might not be so in love with that shot because he'd be convinced he'll get a cash in to shoot three later on.
Could be, but you know,
maybe.
but we're
but he also
we're
has
but
been, like you said, he's taken a lot of those shots throughout his career anyway.
Yeah. For a guy who is as kind of a specialist, a shooter as he is, he's always, when I've looked at this, he's always kind of had a higher than expected proportion of his shots after kind of a significant touch time on the ball. If I define self created shots as 2.5 seconds with the ball or more, he's always, you know, you guys who are pure catch and shoots players are in like the, you know, 80%+ of their shots come with less than 2.5 seconds of touch time. He's been kind of in the high 50s or 60s. So just significantly less of a kind of designated shooter as you might want him to.
That's interesting, and I would not have thought that.
Yeah, I'm quoting that from memory, so I could be slightly off, but his proportion of his shots coming with him trying to create has been surprisingly high for the couple of years we have data.
All right, so the late game obviously wound up being not as close as it was through most of the first half. The first thing I want to talk about is very quickly, those Memphis throwbacks are incredible.
They really are. This was a great uniform game both ways, I think.
Yes. But if any jersey in the league was calling out for an alternate court like the Bucks and Grizzlies have designed, or sorry, the Bucks and Warriors have designed, it's those Memphis Sounds jerseys. Like, you could do such a cool concept with those colors, and it just looked strange with those red and white jerseys on the, you know, the blue and gold court for the Grizzlies. And you could do, I think, a lot of cool stuff with the Sounds and the Grizzlies and the different colors if they were to design an alternate court, and I hope they do it next year.
And the font too. I think
the
font of the jerseys.
Yeah.
And this has been
ripped on the back of the jersey for the names. Oh, those jerseys are gorgeous.
Yeah. This has been Jared and Seth's aesthetics podcast, and but I don't know, that even from the start of this game, there's a little bit almost of a fool's gold element. We talked about you know the Thunder getting a good stretch from Dion Waiters at the start of the fourth. The Grizzlies got a good stretch from Jeff Green at the start of the game, which of course led to the
Jeff Green. Let's talk about Jeff Green.
which of course the rhapsody from commentators about how, you know, talented Jeff Green is, and how if Memphis is going to, then Jeff Green needs to, and it's like, well, then you're basically saying Memphis is not going to, because, you know, I don't, at a certain point, the guy is what he is, and expecting, you know, some kind of blossoming into this all-star player, people still think he has the potential to be. It's a triumph of hope over extended experience.
Yeah, to me, he sort of personifies the difference between a combo forward and a tweener. A combo forward is a guy that can play the three and the four and play them both well, like Harrison Barnes or like Paul Millsap, you know. And then a tweener is a guy who plays at both the three and the four because he's of that size, but doesn't do either one of them particularly well, albeit for different reasons. You know, he's not quick enough laterally on defense to stay in front of threes. He doesn't have enough shooting to play at that spot and not cramp your spacing. But then while he's quicker than most fours on offense, he's not strong enough to guard them on defense. And if you put him on the back line, it's a disaster.
And he's not quick enough and a good enough finisher to fully exploit fours on offense.
Right. And, you know, that's not to say he's not a talented player or he's a player completely without merit, but there's just a difference between a guy like him who swings between those positions because he's that size and other guys who swing between those positions because they bring different aspects that give them an advantage at each position. And I never feel like he has an advantage on the floor, no matter which of the two positions he's at. And that's what makes him a tweener versus a combo forward. And there's definitely a difference between those two things.
Yeah,
I do want to
he's.
point out, this is something that Chris Harrington, who writes for the Memphis Commercial Appeal, brought up on Twitter. The Grizzlies now are 0-5 and have been completely destroyed in games against the Warriors, Cavs, and Spurs. 0-5 against those three teams, or the three best teams in the league right now, and they're 11-4 against everybody else. So that's, I think, something that tells you exactly where they are as a team.
Yeah.
They're a good team, but they're just not in the same class as the class of the league.
They're a little bit almost Boston West to the extent that it's still weird that Memphis is in the West. By the way, I just to speak of that, like, shouldn't Oklahoma City, Miami be like a to this extent we have divisions? Shouldn't that be like a division rivalry kind of these teams play four times a year and just in contrast of like the cities and the styles, isn't that wouldn't that be a natural, like interesting rivalry if they were ever going to, actually align the teams geographically? Anyway, that was a thought that struck me during the game last night. But sorry, back to Memphis. Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think that some of that is just again limitations of personnel. Like one of the stat that jumps out of this game was the 3-point shooting, and that's a stat that's kind of always going to jump out unfavorably to Memphis, just because for the nth year in a row they don't have enough shooting, and that's especially. Against those top teams, like what's the big differentiating factor between, those teams you just mentioned and kind of many of the other teams is the volume of quality 3-pointers they can put up. And Memphis is just they're battling so hard against the math there.
Yeah, and that's why it was such a culture shock in this game to see San Antonio and Memphis both playing small at the same time, which happened near the end of the first quarter. It happened in the second half too, but by then the game was already out of hand. But these are the two teams that are still sort of staidly sticking to two traditional big men in the front court with Aldridge, Duncan, and Randolph Gasol. And then all of a sudden, you see at the end of the first quarter, they're both going small at the same time. I was like, is this really a Spurs Grizzlies game? It was very strange to see that.
The Spurs really ever go small though? I mean, because they just they
Before
have,
David West is small to me.
yeah. But I mean, you've got guys who like is it you're putting guys in like Diaw and Kyle Anderson and stuff like that. They're going medium rather than going small. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. With that Spurs second unit though, Patty Mills, Ginobili, Kyle Anderson, Diaw, and David West. I said this on Twitter during the game. I feel like it would be so much more effective if they had sort of a high flying pick and roll knife man slash, bouncy rim protector in that David West spot. It would just make things so much more open, for Patty Mills to do his Patty Mills thing where he comes off the screen and like jets around as fast as humanly possible and then either takes a pull-up jumper or gets it to Ginobili, who then does the exact same thing, it would open things up for Kyle Anderson in his passing, for Dion in his passing. I just feel like West is a poor fit with that group in specific. You know, is that something you feel too, or do you like it, or what?
I on one hand, I see what you're saying. On the other hand, I think that David West has good ball skills, and so that, you know, individually, like a pick and roll with David West isn't like, it's not going to, like, if you replace David West with, say, Jeremy Evans, like, you'll get some of that, like
I was going to say Brandon Knight, who doesn't play for Memphis right now.
Yeah, but
sorry, Brandon Wright, not Brandon Knight.
Brandon Wright, right, yeah. Well, you'll get that specific play might be better, but at the same time, like, you know, a lot of what San Antonio does is predicated on the ball not sticking and moving side to side and stuff like that. And I think that those are kind of doesn't necessarily show up on the stat sheet, but that's something that David West, for example, is much better at than those type of players tend to be. If you get at the very top end, like, yes, you get a pick and roll crash guy who also has good, you know, passing ball skills, or
like Tiago,
like
Tiago Splitter.
Yeah, but he wasn't, bouncy.
He's not the kind of passer that David West is, but
yeah,
he can keep the machine moving, which I think that he's done for the most part in Atlanta too.
Yeah, but I think in terms of what you're asking for, I mean, I don't necessarily think he is a, if I'm thinking like finishing at the rim in traffic.
He's sort of the halfway medium between West and the kind of guy I'm describing.
Yeah. Yeah, the Spurs have never really had that guy, have they?
I don't think so.
And to some extent, there's a reason for that. Is like a guy who is good at that skill and has the ball skills is kind of out of their price range for kind of that fourth big spot. You know what I mean? Like, or is like David Lee and has, other limitations that make him less than desirable.
Right. And that's why I think they sort of have Kiel as a medium between that.
Yeah.
He's not a guy who's going to be high flying, but he can make all of those plays. He can roll and he can pop. He'll keep the machine moving and he can post up. Oh, God, I love that dude. He's great.
Yeah. And honestly, the guy they have that's closest to that is probably Kawhi. And though as he becomes more of a primary scorer,
have you ever seen him roll off a screen?
I think he did that more. He kind of in their title team, he would kind of roll to kind of the bottom of the circle, and then maybe not finish on the roll, but kind of do a semi post up and then shoot a little jump hook or something like that. But still would draw defense that way. As he's become more of a primary scorer, he kind of does that less because he wants to catch the ball in his spots and go to work. But I think he could operate as that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put anything past him at this point. I think he could probably do pretty much anything he asked him to do.
Yeah.
That boy good.
Yeah.
There was, one other thing I noticed during this game, I don't know if one of your if one of the nerds at Nylon Calcus has looked into this, but I would love to see pick and roll location data. Like, who runs more side pick and rolls than San Antonio? It seems like more often than anybody else, they have those initiated from the side as opposed to the top, just because of the way their offense is run. And I would bet that they run more from the sides as opposed to the middle than any other team.
That could be. It's a good question. That's hard to pull from most public data. I think part of that is all
have it by player. I don't know if they have it by team.
Yeah. I was gonna say though, I think part of that is they're able to run because they're kind of running pick and roll off motion. So it's like ball reversal, flare screen into a side pick and roll. They actually can run them a little cleaner where, you know, if a team tries to just like come down and run a side pick and roll, on the broadcast, you can hear, you know, everyone on the opposing bench and on the floor for the defense and probably half the fans screaming out ice to, you know, down that pick and roll. But since they run it off motion, they can actually,
you
know,
get Thibodeau screaming it from his house right now.
Yeah. You get some, you know, they actually can get some middle penetration off that because it happens sort of organically out of the continuity of their offense rather than just being, we are going to run a side pick and roll. And so that's, I think that the sort of continuity that the Spurs have and that Aldridge has kind of fit in better and better as the season has gone on, allows them to do some things execution wise that other teams can't match. And that's, both a function of that's largely personnel related, I think, is because, you know, they have sought out players who can do that, who can, you know, make decisions quickly, both in terms of what to do with the ball, but most importantly for something like that is what to do and where to move off the ball, which is really, you know, I think something that I think you'd agree kind of characterizes a Spursy offense.
I may or may not be writing a longer thing about that specific skill, but I'm glad you brought up Aldridge because that was actually where I was going next, and I guess this will be, I guess, the last thing we sort of talk about before we go off here. When they were in New York earlier this season, Pop, you know, was asked about how he's trying to incorporate Aldridge into their offense, which is obviously much different from the way he played Portland. You know, all the different things we talked about, keeping the ball moving, not necessarily letting it stick, moving off the ball, different things. It's all a lot different than the way he played Portland, where he just sort of ran to his favorite spot on the left block. And he either got a post up there or he came up and set a screen for one of his high pick and rolls, pick and pops, whatever it was. And the way he said he was doing it was he's not coaching LaMarcus. He's treating him like they treated Tim Duncan early in his career, where they're just letting him play and seeing the kinds of things that he can do. And then they're going to figure out how to orient themselves, work that into their offense as the season goes along. And that is not something you would hear from pretty much any other coach, I don't think. And it was really interesting to me, and that's why, you know, there are people that are concerned already about how he's fitting, about how he's not scoring as much, and people might not, and that he might be upset about that. I have not really been concerned about that specifically because of that answer that Pop gave when he was here. You know, what do you think about, you know, both that answer, what he said, and then how that process is going for them so far?
That's a good quote because I was kind of going to say he's doing the same things, but in a way that fits with the Spurs offense. You know, he is still getting the ball in his spots, but he's getting the ball in his spots in kind of their flow has sort of absorbed, you know, how he likes to play. And he's one of his best skills offensively is his mobility. And it's not necessarily like he's straight line fast though he is. It's his ability to kind of move in space and change directions and pivot and roll and stuff like that. And that, you know, even if he prefers to kind of get the ball either kind of in the left mid post or kind of the left elbow extended and make a play, you can still incorporate that fairly easily as long as the people on the court kind of recognize that's where he's going to gravitate. And it really seems like the Spurs he's adopting a little bit to the Spurs and the rest of the Spurs are adopting a little bit to him. And it doesn't, it doesn't seem like, all right, let's stop and watch LaMarcus now, is something that happens especially frequently with you know their offense. It happens, you know, if anything, stopping and watching Kawhi happens far more often in their offense than you know letting LaMarcus get his stuff in.
It doesn't seem like they're going out of their way to say, oh, we have to throw the ball into LaMarcus in the post now and watch him work.
Yeah.
It's like you said, it's more of, you know, let's run this middle pin down for Kawhi and let him isolate at the top of the key, or let's get Kawhi in the post on this guy that's smaller than him. That does seem to be happening a little bit more often than let's watch LaMarcus right
Yeah,
now.
and I think that, by the way, I think that's by design to a degree, kind of to force feed Kawhi into, you know, to kind of bring him out of his shell. Because again, as when he first came into the league, he was not a offensive creator, and so these are kind of learned skills, and for him to learn these skills, they have to be practiced, and so they are. I think there's definitely some intentionality in terms
Oh, definitely. And it's
of.
not just in terms of creating for himself and looking to score, but also learning when he has to pass out of that situation. You know, if they bring an extra defender, what he's supposed to do then, when you've not really dealt with that situation on the ball all that often throughout your career, you've got to see it to know how to react. And in order to see it, it's got to be designed for you. Because he's not necessarily the kind of guy who's going to break the offense to isolate. But if they design it for him, then he'll do it.
Right, and that's I think this is something that Pop has talked about, but it's something you hear a lot is you know, just because the play is called for you doesn't mean you have to shoot. And you know, first of all, just getting the play called for you and getting used to that, and then all right, well, the play is called for me, so I'm going to, so I do have to shoot, is kind of actually I think a useful, there's some useful reps there, I think, for a while. And it seems like he's a little, is still in that stage of his offensive development, and which is fine. And then the next step is kind of adding in the better decisions on, all right, I made a move and now it's time to move the ball again. Kind of decision. And that's, it's a progression, and that's the next kind of progression in his development.
Absolutely. All right, man. That's all I got. You got anything more to talk about from that game, or anything you want to push out there?
No, we're still kind of, we're season's in full swing, adding new stats all the time at Nylon Calculus. Something fun that I did this week was with the positional playing time stuff, I was able to separate individual player production by position. So I, like, if you want to know what Draymond Green is doing at center, and I wrote an article for the Washington Post about this, he's averaging like 19, 8, 9, 1, and 3 per 36 minutes as a center on 80% true shooting. So that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's it for us today. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow. You can follow me at JADubin5. You can find this podcast and all the other HB Basketball Network podcasts by going to Hardwood Paroxysm and then clicking the link at the top of the page for the HB Basketball Network Podcast Center. Or you can find us on iTunes for searching for Hardwood Paroxysm, HB Basketball Network, or Quo Vadis. Check out all of our stuff at Hardwood Paroxysm, Nylon Calculus, Upside Motor Friendly Bounce. Seth, thanks a lot, man. We're going to do this again next week. The TNT game's on Thursday, December, I guess it's the 10th, are Clippers Bulls and my Knicks against Boogie and the Sacramento Kings. That should be pretty fun because Porzingis against Boogie. I might die of happiness. It's going to be great. Thanks a lot, man.